listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Paul Strolley right here on LA Talk Radio.
Yes, you are.
Yes, you are.
On this last day of spring.
This last day of spring.
Because tomorrow is officially summer.
It is officially summer. And of course, it doesn't. It changes like here in LA. You so know the difference from one day to another.
Absolutely, yes.
I told you my whole appraisal of LA because there's no sense of the passage of time.
No.
You make a drink.
I have a feeling I'm going
to
hear it.
I'm going to tell you. You make a drink, you go down to the pool, and then you're 80. That's what it is. That's what living in Los Angeles is.
That's why Jonathan is getting out now.
Yeah, he's
right?
getting out now. Yes, yes.
Well, hello to you, sir. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good.
It's been a week.
No, I had a horrible week, actually.
Why is that?
And I'm going to skip right over it because it has nothing to do with the business or anything like that. I had some something go on in my condo board because I'm president of my homeowners association.
A little shake up there.
Little coup d'état, and we formed a power block, and we did. But it was just all the dreck that you get when you live in a condo.
Yeah.
You got all that, so it was stressful, but it's gone, and I'm throwing it out into the ether. How about you? How was your week?
Just the same old, busy. But we've got such a packed show today.
We do.
Fantastic people on the show. I think we need to get right to.
Hit the ground. Running.
But of course, before we do that, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Breakdown Services, the entertainment industry standard used around the world, providing the most professional means to reach talent agents as well as actors when casting a project. And to learn more about Breakdown Services, simply visit them at BreakdownExpress.com.
Oh, we'd also like to acknowledge PerformingArtsLive.com, one of the Internet's most prominent listing sources for the live arts in Southern California. We're grateful to Performing Arts Live for lending their support to our live arts calendar.
As always, and in studio with us today, ladies and gentlemen, we have the gorgeous and talented Broadway star, Eileen Barnett, who will be in town this weekend headlining her wonderful supper club act, You Must Believe in Spring, on Sunday, June 23rd, and we will give you more specific. I can't even say specific.
You're drunk, Sterling. You're drunk.
Again?
How many times do I have to tell you?
Specifics.
Later.
Yes, we will.
And from the Los Angeles premiere of the London West End smash hit Yes, Prime Minister, currently on stage at the Geffen Playhouse, which I caught on opening night. And
I know you did.
Absolutely delighted. Specifics. Delighted.
Yeah.
Give me them. We have the show's playwright and director, Jonathan Lynn, is here with us. And we'll be with him in a moment.
Nice.
And you know what? I want to throw some applause out to Eileen because we didn't
of
get
course.
That to her either.
That's right. He wasn't on his toes.
I wasn't on my toes, yes.
And
specifics
that's
threw
Paul.
Me, Michael. You threw me with the specifics.
Damn
see,
it.
Now I'm
Damn
fighting
it.
To catch up.
I'm so sorry. That's not all, Paul. We're also fortunate to have one of the stars of Yes, Prime Minister live on the telephone with us. And you know him from his fine work in film and television. On Broadway and theater everywhere.
From films such as This Is Spinal Tap, which you can't even begin to talk about because that would be an hour. Best in Show, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, to television's Castle, Law & Order, Homeland, Curb Your Enthusiasm, and Laverne and Shirley, on which he co-starred as Lenny Kosnowski. And I just want to say, I had the Lenny and the Squig Tones album. That's
Holy
how much I was into
cannoli.
It. Yes.
Really?
It was an LP. I'm dating myself.
Oh, yes, yes, you are. How is that going for you?
But
to New York theater, ladies and gentlemen, such as The Best Man, King Lear, The Pajama Game, and Hairspray, and as if that's not enough in a vast arsenal of work, he is not only the first $1 million Jeopardy celebrity champion, he is also a Grammy Award winner and an Oscar nominee for Best Song. I'm exhausted, Paul, just reading this intro. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Michael McKean.
Michael McKean.
Thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, please sit down.
Well, we're out of time. So there we go. Mr. McKean, how are you? Thank you so much for joining us and on
I'm
the air.
I'm fine, thank you. I'm fine. I'm right here in my house.
Yes.
It couldn't be more convenient.
It couldn't be
easier. In fact,
easier.
I'm now stepping out into the sunshine, and the sunshine is so hot, I'm stepping back in.
Well, Michael, as I said earlier, I did see the show, Yes, Prime Minister. I enjoyed it immensely. And my first thought, if we can jump right into it, is that someone like you, who so many people know through the Christopher Guest films and your improvisational prowess, with a show like this, with a show that is, you know, so wonderfully comic and visually comic, but also has such a density of wordplay and so much... you know, sort of rat-a-tat-tat banter. Is there room for exploiting those talents, the improv talents, with something like this, or do you really have to sort of stick to the script, as it were?
oh, well, we definitely stick to the words or the dialogue. Right. But, you know, Jonathan is very precise, but he also really likes to laugh. So, if you're trying something in the course of rehearsal, not so much the words, because we were very happy with the words. I think it's an amazing script, and everybody gets some, you know. I mean, everybody gets some laughs in this show. It's so much fun, and the audiences have been red hot. So, just beyond that, if an attitude takes a little slip and slide and it's funny and it makes Jonathan laugh, then we explore that. So now that we're up and running and the audiences are kind of telling us what to do, you know, they say keep it coming.
Oh, yeah. No, I really enjoyed it, and I just, Michael, you've got to see this one.
I plan on seeing it, yeah. Yes, before.
Yeah. Did you find that maybe this is a question for both of you, for you and Jonathan as well. Was it there adaptations that had to be made for an American audience, or was it, you know, because I mean obviously it's about the British Prime Minister, but do you find things that are maybe singing a little more here or not being as appreciated here?
No.
Hello, Jonathan. Good morning.
Yep. Hello, Michael. How are you?
good.
Every audience is slightly different, even when you're in the same theatre in the same town.
Right.
So every night there are solid markers. There are big moments that get the big laughs, and then otherwise it's sort of variable slightly from night to night.
Right.
But I haven't found it different from England.
Really?
I've made a few small adjustments to the script, just in terms of language. For instance, what we call a diary, you call a calendar.
Oh, good.
Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. You know, there are things like that which
just for clarification
purposes. Sure. But
yeah.
And I've changed one or two jokes that I thought would be meaningless to an American audience, and put in new ones which I thought actually were better. But no, essentially, it's exactly the same show.
Okay, was curious about that. Michael, do you find that one of the things I dug so much about your portrayal was that, you know, initially when you take the stage, it's almost the feeling that you're a bit of an empty suit of a prime minister. But then there are there are moments where you really show your political prowess in dealing with some of these ambassadors and that. And was that a tough? It was a great portrayal, and I'm just curious about drawing that balance about, you know, having the character not get too farcical, so in those moments of clarity you were able to sort of get the job done. Was that a tough balance to draw for you as an actor?
No, the way the play is constructed, I'm really set up to be sort of a cipher or a vacuum. I'm actually referred to as a vacuum before I come on.
Yes.
And which doesn't mean that I suck. You know, it just means that there's nothing there. But the thing is, he is a talented politician and he's not a dumbbell.
Right.
And he also sees it dawns on him when he's being manipulated, and he's talented enough that he can manipulate back. And so I think gradually we see him doing the right thing, not always saying the right thing, and also sorely tempted to do the wrong thing for personal benefit and for the benefit of the country, in his view. But if you boil it all down, he's a fairly decent guy.
Yeah.
I can't imagine being a politician. I can't imagine doing something like that. So you know, it's not for me. I can't match up anything about Jim Hacker with my own, you know, life and ambitions, etc. It's just we run in different circles. But it's really fun inhabiting this guy. And you know, Jonathan, actually, there were times when he really had to remind me, this guy's really talented. This guy is doing this not because he's just thinking of it. He's really good at this.
I think the important point is that... sorry to interrupt you, Michael. I think the point is that politicians are head of... Prime ministers and presidents are essentially head of public relations for their government. And and their job is to get re-elected and to get the party re-elected. That's actually their job. Everything comes second to that. And Jim
and that works on both sides of the Atlantic.
Both sides of the Atlantic, and
sure.
And Jim is really good at that. So although he may not be good at many things, you know, when you put him in public and he knows what how he's going to handle a situation, he's absolutely expert. And you can't get to be you know, the top of the greasy pole, right. unless you're good at that.
Unless you have that, those skills,
yes.
Absolutely. I want to call out some of the other people in this incredibly strong cast, and there is not a, and this is not lip service, there is not a weak link on this stage. It's just like, you know, it's a verbal pinball game watching this thing happen. This is Stephen Caffrey as the BBC presenter, Brian George, that many people know from Seinfeld as one of the ambassadors, Dakin Matthews as Sir Humphrey. I would have been impressed by this portrayal if this man was 25 years old. The density of the wordplay that he has to pull off, and the fact that he, you know, the people are applauding his speeches,
yeah.
the night that I was there, and the man, I believe, is 70, and if he was 25 years old, it would be impressive, but it's just so, I mean, he really just lights up that stage.
He made me feel guilty, actually. He told me that it was harder to learn than King Lear, which he played rather brilliantly a couple of years ago.
I saw him in King Lear. He was wonderful.
Did you?
Right.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And also, right up with him, Jefferson Mays, who plays the private secretary.
Right.
Tara Summers as Claire Sutton. And, of course, Tyme Winters, who I've seen do some wonderful work at Theatre Banshee, which is the Irish-themed theatre over in Burbank. I believe he did Merchant of Venice over there. Mm-hmm. Did some great, great work. But just a wonderfully strong cast. And I'm sure that the audiences are still giving it the response that we saw opening night, which was just standing ovation and just really a crackling performance. And I also want to say something about it that I really want to give the actors some kudos here, you especially, Michael. There was a little audience upheaval on opening night. There was a little disruption, and someone took ill during the performance. And I tell you, those people on stage, they did not miss a beat. They stayed right with it. There was just real artistry.
No, somebody had to be helped out. He went into some kind of diabetic coma briefly.
Mm-hmm. Oh dear Lord.
And and the cast were amazing. They just didn't affect them. And you know, normally
To be fair, Jonathan, we would have been useless to him. So it's not like he had jumped into the audience. Stand back, I'm an actor. You know, no one does that, and we don't either. So we just let the professionals take care of it.
I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV.
Yeah.
Michael, what is next for you after this? What's on your dance card?
Well, I got about a month off, and then I'm going to run up to Cambridge, Massachusetts. There's a play called All the Way, which we are doing. Bryan Cranston is playing Lyndon Johnson. I'm playing J. Edgar Hoover.
Oh, wow.
Reed Birney, who is one of the best actors alive, is playing Humphrey, Hubert Humphrey, in this case. Just a whole boatload of terrific people, including Dakin Matthews.
Oh,
so
really?
I'm only going to work with Dakin Matthews from now on, and I couldn't be happier.
Yes, you'd be hard pressed for a better scene partner. Thank you
awesome.
So much, Michael. It's been great having
may
you
I
on
say,
the air.
May I say happy birthday to David L. Lander, my partner on Laverne and Shirley for those many years, a man I've known for many, many decades.
Oh,
well, so happy birthday, David.
Happy birthday to David Lander. And Michael, did you hear on the air at the beginning of the thing, had I connected your mic when I mentioned that I did have the Lenny and the Squig Tone album?
Yes, yes. Indeed. Casablanca Records, yeah.
Yes.
Boy, there's an unpublishable novel.
Michael, can you give us the stats to let people know how to see Yes, Prime Minister?
I'm so happy to do that. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it's on stage right now at the Geffen Playhouse through Sunday, July 14th. And it stars a fabulous cast, as you well know, led by Michael McKeon here. And performance schedule is Mondays. They're off. And Tuesday through Friday, 8 p.m., Saturday, 3 p.m. and 8 p.m., and Sunday at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. And for tickets, you simply call the Geffen Playhouse, and that is 310-208-5454, or you can purchase them online at geffenplayhouse.com. It's as simple as that.
A pleasure, Mr. McKeon. It was
a true
joy having you on the air. We're going to look forward to talking about the show a little more, as well as chatting with Miss Eileen Barnett, who is here with us. But thank you so much.
Michael.
Thank you so much for joining us. We are very grateful.
You're so welcome. Thank you, guys.
Bye now.
Lovely man.
Lovely man, and I got to tell you, I am I am not normally one who's a little on the nervous side.
I know.
And I was a little nervous because I just so appreciate Mr. McKeon and all that he's done.
Yeah.
I was a little, I don't mind telling you. It was a little bit edgy.
Well, that,
a little bit edgy.
That's good, Paul. That's good for you, right?
No, just really, really, really dig his work. There's just certain people that you just, you know, just follow for years and years, and they just consistently do good work, and it's so appreciated.
You're very devoted. I
yes,
know that.
I am. When I'm a devoted
fan.
When
you find someone like a Michael
exactly.
McKeon,
right? Yeah.
Who deserves a lovely career that he has.
Exactly.
So, Paul.
I'm giving this next gentleman, our next guest, the intro that he is due.
Yes, absolutely. And now, ladies and gentlemen, for the brains behind the hilarity of Yes, Prime Minister,
brains.
He began his career as an actor at age 23 in the original West End company of London's Fiddler on the Roof. As a director, his London credits include The Glass Menagerie, working with Tennessee Williams, the multi-award-winning musical Songbook, Anna Christie, excuse me, at the Royal Shakespeare Company, Stratford and the Donmar in London, to numerous productions as artistic director at the distinguished Cambridge Theatre Company, and as a director of films, he not only directed the cult classic Clue, but wrote the screenplay as well, directed My Cousin Vinny and The Whole Nine Yards, to name but a few. For British television, he co-created the uber-successful award-winning BBC series Yes, Minister and Yes, Prime Minister. He is also an author whose latest book, Comedy Rules, has received such great notices that it's actually in the hands of Paul Sterling today.
It is.
You might
it's
actually
right
get a little autograph.
Yes, I'm hoping to.
If you play
to.
Your cards right.
I'm
please,
hoping to.
Please welcome the co-playwright and director of Yes, Prime Minister at the Geffen Theater, Jonathan Lynn.
Thank you. It's I'd just like to thank all of you, this enormous crowd here today.
Yes. They come with the territory.
Brought the who with them, man. That's
yeah,
impressive.
Yeah,
that's impressive.
Well, they go with me everywhere.
That's just a given.
Jonathan, it occurred to me that as we leapt right into talking about Yes, Prime Minister, that maybe the listeners could use a little synopsis of what takes place.
Yes,
would you mind sharing
so.
That with our listeners?
Actually, I think I would, because I think that
really?
the surprise, I think the twists and turns of the plot would be
very good point.
Maybe better discovered when you're sitting in the audience.
So we can say that it's about a prime minister.
We can say it's about a British prime minister. his and because it's a farcical comedy, it's therefore about the worst day of his life. It takes place on a Friday evening. At his official country residence, which is called Chequers, which is our equivalent of Camp David.
Right.
And he's gone there for the evening, and one catastrophe after another happens. The Eurozone implodes, which of course it's doing at this very moment. There's a further crisis with oil and with the pound. There's an illegal immigrant discovered working in the kitchens. just one disaster after another, and yeah. He has to deal with them in the course of this one evening.
And so for America, we just call that Thursday.
Yeah.
it's pretty much like the last couple of weeks Obama's had.
Yeah. this was a series in Great Britain,
yes.
And I'm fascinated by the process of distilling a series down to a stage play, and right. How do you know what to scrap?
The interesting thing is we didn't distill anything.
You didn't?
We'd written the series on and off for 7 years. There's nothing from the series in the play. It's an original play. It's as if I don't know how to put it without sounding grandiose, but if you've got very well loved characters in a series, like for instance Conan Doyle had with Sherlock Holmes or whatever, it would be as if he had written a new Sherlock Holmes story. That's what this is. This is a new story about Jim Hacker.
Just
as
put the characters in it.
The characters are there. All the characters that the public knew and loved are there, but it's a completely new play.
Okay, so all the characters in the stage play exist in the series?
No, the three main characters.
Oh, the
in
three
the play.
Main characters.
There's
okay.
a new character called Claire Sutton, who's played by Tara Summers, who's yes. wonderful. Your listeners may know her from
Boston Legal. Yes.
And she's playing the Prime Minister's new special advisor. Then there's some other guest performances, as it were.
Yeah, as there would be if it were
characters
episode,
coming and going. Yes, but three main characters are the same, and we wrote them the same way, but they're completely different from how they were in the series because they're played by different actors. And you know, the thing that was most interesting for us was to see how the characters would be received with new interpretations. We'd had Paul Eddington and Nigel Hawthorne, who were two of our greatest actors, playing the parts on television in England. And when we put the play on in London, we thought maybe people will miss them dreadfully. But actually, which was very gratifying, they didn't. They remember and revere them, but they were very happy to see new interpretations of the same.
Well, and I think you just hit on it there. It's interpretations. It's not trying to replicate something that happened. It's they're honoring the role, and they're not trying to blindly parrot someone who played it before them.
No, that would have been disastrous,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah. But, you know, that does, I mean, unfortunately, that does happen.
Yes, so. I think it would be a horrible mistake. We really tried to cast it as differently as possible. Yeah. We set out to...
Oh, intentionally. Just broke that.
Yes.
Yeah, broke that connection.
Yes.
Jonathan, may I ask, how did you segue from being an actor into being a writer and in your youth?
I was selling records at Selfridges, mm-hmm, owing to a shortage of acting work. Mm-hmm. And I thought, if I don't do something creative, I'll go crazy. And I wrote a TV movie. And to my astonishment, it was bought. I had beginner's luck. It was bought.
And how old were you at that point?
23.
You were 23 as an actor, and then you wrote this
yes
film.
Yes. And it was never made, uh-huh, but it was bought, and that was very encouraging. Uh-huh. And then I wrote for another 5 years with zero success, acting a lot. Uh-huh. I was on television, you know, two or three times a week. I was one of those people that you always see on television. Mm-hmm. And I actually grew to hate it. I grew to dislike being a public property. And I was one of those absurd actors who you occasionally see walking around with a big hat and sunglasses and trying to pretend.
It's like Paul.
Yes, exactly.
Like Paul on the weekends.
Yeah. And then I was acting in a very successful comedy series. And 1 week, the writers failed to deliver a good enough script. And another actor and I, who was in the cast with me, we decided, well, let's see if we can do it. So we wrote an episode and gave it to the producer, and he loved it and put it in the schedule.
Wow.
And it was really went well, beginner's luck again. And after that, such is the dearth of people who can, you know, write a half-hour comedy script that's actually funny. Mm-hmm. We found ourselves swamped in no time with offers to write more scripts, and we wrote, I think, about 50 episodes for different shows in the next 5 years. And then in the meantime, I'd started directing, which was, again, tremendously fun and challenging. And so I gradually phased out the acting.
Mm-hmm. And you never look back? You don't get a tinge to go and act every once in a while?
I think it's great fun. And if somebody offered me an interesting part, I would probably do it.
Yeah.
But I think I've been directing and writing for so long that I think people, on the whole, would avoid... they'd think I'd want to be in charge, whereas, of course, the pleasure would be in not being in charge of anything except myself.
I don't mean to speak for you, but it seems to me your issue is more with celebrity than with acting.
I loved acting.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
that's
yes. I really didn't enjoy being... people shouting at me in the street.
All right. Yeah. You're the acting equivalent of Van Morrison. Because Van Morrison said that. He goes, I'm an introvert in an extrovert business, and it's not a good thing. You know?
Don't you think that most actors who are really, really good actors and very dedicated to their craft are those who are much more, stay out of that, not necessarily stay out of the spotlight, they just don't participate.
I think a great many do. I think the problem is in the life of being an actor. Mm. You are constantly, there's so much rejection. There's so much striving to get a part that you know you can play well and you don't get. Mm-hmm. There's so much crap you have to act in order to earn a living.
Right.
And after a while, it can be very discouraging. And I think if you can find, a way out of that and still do a job that you're happy with, mm-hmm, that's better.
you know, as you know, Michael, it's continually my quest to be the most arrogant, unsuccessful actor that there is. That's my goal. I want to try to be the most unknown ass.
Well,
that's what
you know,
for.
That's a stiff competition.
Yes, I was going to say.
There's a lot of us. There's a lot of us.
Be known for something.
Jonathan, we mentioned Clue earlier, and I was curious about something. We talked about my cousin Vinny before we came on the air. But one of the things I was curious about with Clue, and if I remember correctly, was Clue the first time for a film where the alternate endings were given as an option? Was that the first time it was done?
First and I think last time.
First and last time.
For very good reason. one of the producers,
I wasn't sure how it worked out, so I couched that question very carefully.
One of the
terribly.
Producers had the idea that if I could write a script that was sufficiently ingenious that the outcome could be explained with three different solutions, we'd put those three different endings in three different theaters. Actually, it was four originally. And people would be so intrigued, they would go and see it three or four times, and the film would make even more money. In fact, what happened was the exact opposite. The people thought, well, I don't know which ending to go and see, so I'll go and see something else.
Oh my.
So it was really a disastrous idea. Also, of course, the alleged cleverness of this notion didn't work unless you saw all the endings.
Okay.
Saw how different they were. So, or how they worked. So, in fact, the film didn't become a success till it was put out on VHS.
Okay, and you had that.
And
option.
Then we put all the endings on it, and suddenly people began to love it
because they could get.
Yeah, so it was really it's the first and last time anyone, and I strongly recommend nobody else to attempt.
Trial by error.
Yes. Yeah. Although, like now, in the DVD age, if it would be a very, you know, to go through and just click.
Oh, it's fun to see them on the DVD. I think.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I enjoyed it.
I certainly played the game.
And, of course, Michael McKean was in there.
Yes, no. Well, yeah, Michael McKean and
yes,
great
yes.
cast in that. Madeline Kahn.
Madeline Kahn.
Tim
amazing.
Curry.
Tim
Curry.
Yeah, wonderful cast.
Yeah, no. So,
I've always been very spoiled. I've just always been lucky enough to work with really talented people. And, you know, it makes your life so much better.
Well, and they as well, because they get to work with you.
Sure.
And,
were they chosen by you? Or?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes,
lucky
that's what directors do largely.
Well, no, I know that.
They make decisions,
and then they
hide in the corner and say action and cut. That's right. About it.
Sometimes you have to settle for someone that you don't.
Yes, you do have to occasionally, but I tend not to. I tend to walk away from a project if an actor is imposed upon me who I don't think is right.
Good for you. Good for you. I believe that.
Before we chat with Eileen, I just want to ask Jonathan to share the story that he shared before we came on the air, because I was saying that my brother and I love to share lines from movies, and one of our favorites is My Cousin Vinny, and the scene with the vastly underappreciated Fred Gwynn in the courtroom scene where Joe Pesci says, "So anyway, the two Utes," and he says, "Excuse me, what is a Ute?" And he said, "I'm sorry, the two youths." So it's a great exchange between Fred Gwynn and Joe Pesci. And you said that was actually something that happened between the two of you?
It actually happened between me and Joe. We were in the Mayflower Hotel in New York, and we were talking about the script about a month before we started shooting. And he said to me, "Well, you see, there's these two youths." And I said, "What?" And he said, "Two youths." And I said, "What's a ute? What is a ute?" He said, "What?" And I said, "What? What is a ute? What is a ute?" And you know, and I realized this had to go into the script because it was perfect for Vinny and the judge. I mean, it's a terrific script, which I did not write. Dale Lorna wrote the script, but obviously, as a director, you make changes here and there as you go, and the actors come up with new things. But it was funny, that became one of the most popular exchanges in the movie.
Oh yeah, it's just such a great little self-contained bit, and it's just like that. And you were serious about that? When he's talking about his clothes, you know, were you serious about that? It was a great line read. Anyway, we could go off on these films all day, but today we're talking about Yes, Prime Minister. And Michael, I want to throw that information out there again. It is, the easiest thing, of course, is geffenplayhouse.com to get the tickets. But do you have a more detailed info there?
I do. They can simply, folks, you can call 310-208-5454 to get tickets for this wonderful show, which, as we said earlier, is on stage now through July 14th. So you have plenty of opportunities to see it. It plays Tuesdays through Sundays at various times. And just to go online, check that out. The tickets are certainly affordable, and it's a project you shouldn't miss.
Yeah, and also, as I always like to say, the Geffen's one of those great theaters.
Love the theater.
Park once, walk to food. You have all these options. That's huge in L.A. because, you know, it's not New York and Chicago where you hop in a cab and all that.
So absolutely.
You pitch the evening rather than the show, I'm telling you.
Our
next guest made her debut on Broadway, not on the stage, but as a supportive singer in the orchestra pit of Stephen Sondheim's award-winning musical Company. But it didn't take long for her to move onto the stage in front of the footlights in the off-Broadway hit review Jacques Brel Is Alive and Well and Living in Paris, and in which she also toured. Soon after, she became a resident villain on the daytime mega-hit drama Days of Our Lives and eventually returned to the Broadway, this time co-starring as Luisa Contini opposite Sergio Franchi in Tommy Tune's award-winning musical Nine. I'm Italian. Is that why you gave that to me?
Because
I could get all that out.
That's right.
Getting ready to headline her supper club act at You Must Believe in Spring this Sunday, June 23rd at Sterling's Upstairs at the Federal in the NoHo Arts District of North Hollywood. Please welcome the lovely and oh so talented and very patient Eileen Barnett.
Thank you.
Eileen. Hello, Eileen.
Oh, my people, my people.
Thanks for joining us.
You know,
thank you for having me.
Lives down the street, she told me, from
studio, nearby. Yes,
but it took her.
I know. I have
very
to stay.
To
I have to stay 500 yards away from her, so I know exactly where
she
is. Yes, I'm a stalker. I didn't want to say it on the air, but
they finally issued
I've been
that,
asked
did
to
they?
Keep that distance. Yes.
I see.
Eileen, this show at Sterling's, is it something you've done before? Or are you revisiting it? Or are you tweaking it?
Tweaking.
Okay.
Yes, I did a night at the Colony Theater. I used to do my cabaret act a lot, mm-hmm. and I kind of stopped for a while, and was doing other things. And it's hard to do cabaret, as you know, in this town, because you are responsible for getting your audience in there. So I stopped doing it for a while, and then I did another production of Jacques Brel at the Colony, and the managing director there, Trent Steelman, said, "Why don't you do a night here?" So I did. And I've tweaked it a little bit, changed a little bit, and Michael Sterling we've been talking about doing this for years,
yes,
literally
that's true.
Years.
That's true.
And I finally got my act together, literally. And, and so we're going to do Sterling's finally, and I'm so looking forward to it. And I called it, you know, You Must Believe in Spring, and it's like 2 days into summer, so I don't know what I was thinking. But spring is a metaphor for love, and all the songs
right.
are love songs.
Go.
So there you go. There's my theme.
Is there a narrative? I ask this question all the time, and Michael has indulged me on this, but I'm always curious about, with cabaret, how it works. Is there a narrative that you try to fit? Are the songs picked first and then sort of woven together? What's your process?
Well, you know, it always drives me crazy to have a theme. I mean, unless you're doing a composer or something, mm-hmm. which I'm not doing right now. But you know, if I did, you know, all 13 or 14 songs about spring, it would be very boring. So there's just sort of a kind of a hopeful feeling to most of the songs, and then you throw in a couple comedy things. I mean, I think it's well crafted, and I have a wonderful woman that I work with as my director, a very dear friend and colleague of mine, Kirsten Benton Chandler, who has just really started her directing career, and she is so wonderful.
Such a talented actress and singer herself.
She is incredible. And so she you know, really kind of helped me craft it a little bit, and I've got a, you know, I always like to do a little comedy because I think I'm funny.
Well,
I've been told.
And when you have someone like Billy Barnes writing a piece
for
you as well.
Yeah, Billy Barnes wrote me a song called The Valley when I got married and moved to the Valley. And it's really, because I used to live in West Hollywood, of course, you know. And so, Billy was a very dear friend of mine. So, yeah, I don't know. You know, you kind of, if something doesn't fit, you know, I'm thinking about putting another comedy song in, and I'm going to run it on Friday tomorrow, and if it doesn't work, we'll see how it fits.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you know, kind of start with a spring song, end with a spring song, and that's kind of what I'm doing. So.
You know what's interesting about cabaret is that, and I think you'll agree, Paul, and Jonathan, maybe, I don't know how it is in London, perhaps the same, but many people who are from the musical theater, when you say, do an act, you know, do your own act, do a cabaret act, and they can't even go close to it because they're terrified of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's such a different art form.
Well,
they're not surrounded by a production, by a script.
They're not playing
actors.
A character, essentially.
Yeah.
Or unless
you're
inventing a persona.
Yeah.
That appears to be your character.
It's just you know.
Very raw and in one.
And somebody told me once, when you go to see a cabaret performer, you should know more about them when you leave their show than you did when you came in. So you get to know the person, I think. I mean, you don't want to tell endless stories about your life, but, you know, because that can be boring and nobody cares. But you know, you do want to get...
Eileen Barnett with a vengeance.
But, you know, even if you're doing a composer, there's ways to kind of expose who you are. You know, I've been teaching. I don't know if I told you this. I've been teaching at AMDA, which is a performing arts college. And first of all, I never thought I would teach. I thought... teach. And the reason being, I never thought I would enjoy it, and it has changed my life. I love it. And my first semester, I taught a cabaret class, so it was very helpful to me to kind of ask my students to do the same thing that I was asking, now why am I doing this, and what do you want to say to the world, and you know.
Wow.
So,
Just out of curiosity, why did you think you wouldn't teach? Did you have, I mean, you seemed rather vehement about that. Was it just something that you just... Did you have bad experiences as a student with?
No, I think I used to think, is there a line in Chorus Line or somewhere that they said, those who can't teach? So I thought, well, I'll never teach because I can.
Yeah. And those who can't teach, teach gym.
But, But I also didn't know that I would have that much to give. Mm-hmm. And there's this wonderful actress who also teaches Penny Fuller, you know, Penny Fuller from Applause and many other things. And she said, you're always surprised at how much you know that you didn't think you knew when you start talking to your students.
The minute you have to impart it to someone,
I'm just teaching them. I mean, it's all performance. It's, you know, now I'm teaching audition prep, and it's, what they get up, they sing, I say, don't do that, do that. It's
also
easy.
Very invigorating, isn't it, working with talented young people?
Yes. Even if they're not that talented, it's still kind of challenging and wonderful, But all my students are very talented.
Well, you're there to help them along, exactly.
But to what you just said, if they're not that talented, when they turn the corner and start going in the right direction, that has to be thrilling.
It's thrilling. Yeah. It's thrilling sometimes when kids that are really... you know, not able to do anything, and suddenly they have a breakthrough in class. It's wonderful.
Of course.
It's just wonderful.
You know what? I think we have time to give our listeners a taste of Eileen Barnett.
We have a little bit of Eileen here. The song is called My Romance, and we're going to listen to it right now. This is Eileen Barnett.
Doesn't need a blue lagoon.
Wow, is that lovely.
Wow, is right.
Thank you. Beautiful.
This is gorgeous. Thank and you. So beautifully understated and just so...
And you know what? Well, understood every lyric that she was singing, which a lot of singers just sing the lyrics. You know what I mean?
And you
it's
know
a big
what?
Difference.
And also in the age of The Voice and American Idol, where they feel like, you know, vocal prowess is putting as many curly cues in there as
riffing.
Possible.
Riffing, oh.
Is that I don't
my
know.
My students love to riff.
I don't know the term.
Those vocal gymnastics.
Yeah.
Sustain
all
of those a note. You know, it's good to sustain a note.
Yeah, but no, just that beautiful, really beautiful.
Thank
you
so much.
Really enjoyed that. Matter
truly.
We may have that play us off the air, too, rather than hear the rest of that before the end. It goes into another, The Nearness of You,
yes,
so maybe we'll catch a little
song.
Bit of that at the end as well.
Absolutely.
To see Eileen Barnett live at Sterling's Upstairs at the Federal, this, of course, is at 5303 Lancashire Boulevard in North Hollywood, Sunday, June 23rd, this coming Sunday, 5:30 to 6 is the dinner seating. The performance is at 7. Reservations are a must. 818-754-8700. That's 818-754-8700. It is selling very, very well, which is the cue to say call immediately, because otherwise you will not get in. Musical direction by John Boswell. We should throw his name out there.
Wonderful, wonderful guy.
And, Jonathan, if you've never been to this supper club, it's a wonderful place.
I wish I could come. Unfortunately, I'm leaving L.A. tomorrow.
Oh, you are.
But,
you'll come
so
the next
I'm really
time.
Sorry. No. If you're doing it again later, I'll be
she might go to New York.
To come.
Maybe.
Yeah.
You never know.
Hope so.
I want to just pop back to one thing that you said, Eileen. We have about 10 minutes left, and in about 5 minutes, we're going to ask you all about on-stage disasters. We always like to end the show with something embarrassing that happened either in performance, and so chew on that for a little
baptism.
While.
It's kind of our baptism.
Our little button at the end of the show.
Choice
but,
is so vast.
But the in performing solo... like for me, I did a one-person show for about 9 years. I went all over the country with it. And the catalyst behind writing it for me was that I started actually, you know, in my late 30s, early 40s, to suffer from incapacitating stage fright out of nowhere. Just completely took me out. So I decided, well, how do you stare down this dragon? Let me write an autobiographical one-person show, which someone once said to me is like an autobiographical solo show is standing on stage naked and turning around slowly, which I just thought was a great description of that. But how do you find, is it different for you when you're solo as far as your performance anxiety, as far as how you perform, or is it just another role as though you were sharing the stage with other people?
Well, I feel more responsible for what I'm doing when it's a cabaret because it's all me. It's what I want to do.
Right.
And I do get a really pretty dress to wear. So I don't, you know, I hope they're looking at the dress.
Yeah.
But no, I don't know. You know, it depends. My process always when I'm doing my act about a week before, which is I've just passed over this, but I go, oh, this is crap. Why am I doing this? What am I? That isn't funny. What? And then I calm down and enjoy myself. Yeah. I just love to sing, and it's, you know, I get to do what I want to do, so it's easier, I think. Maybe.
Yeah, it seems to me that one of the things I did when I'm sort of hearing this is that it's almost more like you're hosting this wonderful event for people than that sort of feel. You
sort of, kind of, absolutely.
And you have a great, you know, co-host with the way what Michael puts
so
together.
So gracious
shows
and
yeah.
generous,
yeah.
yes.
Oh, thank
it's
you.
A great place.
For people like you.
Thank you.
We're very selective.
I think it's that time, Michael.
Yes?
I think it's that time.
Is
as, our guests, we spoke about it briefly. I don't think we spoke about it, Jonathan. But at the end of the show, we always like to ask people about some performance disaster, some funny thing that went wrong on stage. Or while it doesn't necessarily have to be on stage, it could have been, you know, while performing anything or something that you observed. Or
I was playing Mikey the baby dragon.
You've jumped off the edge of the pool. There's no diving board there. When you start off with, I was playing Mikey the baby dragon
in Beauty and the Beast, and the costume designer, who was new, young, inexperienced, had constructed a vast fiberglass costume for me. which meant that I could only stand like a kangaroo in a kind of strange hunched position. And it clanked because I had lots of spikes and a long tail.
Oh my God.
And when I ran, when I came onto the stage, I was supposed to be the lovable comic person in the play. When I came on the stage, all the kids cried. And then I was sort of willing to go along with that. But then there was no way to stand up or sit down in this costume. And so one afternoon, I allowed myself to flop forward in the wings and lie on my tummy because I was so exhausted from carrying this thing around. And I found I couldn't get up. I was like a medieval knight in armor. And I heard my cue over the tannoy, we call it. Mr. Lin on stage, please. Mr. Lin on stage, please. And I heard my cue. And I was lying there in the wings, and nobody could see me. I was on the wrong side of the stage. Where is Mr. Lin? So, stage management, find Mr. Lin immediately. The actors were ad-libbing disastrously on stage. And I heard assistant stage managers running all over the building looking for me. And finally, they found me in the wrong wings, hauled me to my feet. And I went onto the stage, and of course, they all cried. And after that, I refused to wear the costume anymore, which made the costume designer cry. and finally, they found me a kind of a sort of green thing, you know, that babies wear, you know, a sort of green overalls thing.
Like a onesuit,
a baby jumpsuit.
Pajamas
made out of
with
green.
With the feet in them.
Yeah, and it had a tail. And the costume designer said it looked dreadful. And I went on, and the children were happy.
Oh, you see, that's what it is.
A happy ending.
But lying backstage on your stomach, unable to move, dressed as a dragon.
That's yes.
Wonderful.
That is just, you know.
Yeah. It's much better than my story. Before I moved to L.A., I worked in Las Vegas, the original, again, dating myself, the original MGM Grand Hotel. And it was... I had to make it was the Kismet scene, and I was in this gorgeous, gorgeous Bob Mackie costume, and I had to walk across the stage. But prior to that, there was a camel that also made the cross, and he left me some little presents on the way, so I sort of had a, you know, kind of find that. That's really all there is. And
was that in Jubilee? Was that the show you were doing? Was that big review?
Hallelujah Hollywood.
Hallelujah Hollywood.
Yeah, it was. It was a low point in my life, let me just say. Working in Vegas. Oh, God.
That would have made the choreography no easier, presumably.
Yeah. Sharing a stage with a camel. And then
so much a camel, it was what the camel left.
That's right. They weren't, and he wasn't nice. He spit.
You know, I've heard that. Yeah, I've heard spit. They're not really pleasant animals.
We stayed away from the animals.
Well, they don't do that intentionally. That's just
No, I love animals. You know, I have five dogs.
Yeah, please do. We'll get calls from PETA. I'm telling you right now. Dare you insult the camel? It's a regal animal. That's hysterical. That's hysterical. Because we have about 2 minutes, this will enable us to have Eileen play us off the air with My Romance. And
we should close by saying, you know, ladies and gentlemen,
The information out there.
Yes, Prime Minister at the Geffen Playhouse. Don't miss it. On stage through July 14th. And Eileen Barnett this weekend on June 23rd at Sterling's upstairs at the Federal in the NoHo Arts District, which is a lovely arts district in North Hollywood with the Television Academy down the street, the Art Institute of California across the street.
You can take the train there.
El Portal Theater across the street.
It's one of the beautiful. Few places in town.
One of the few places that you actually feel like you're in the New York district.
Yeah,
you know,
in the
Broadway district of New York.
Yes, of course they don't have any more prostitutes there, so that's why it's called NoHo.
Oh, no,
late. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm late with my own rim shot there. Tickets for Eileen, 818-754-8700. And, of course, tickets for Yes, Prime Minister is geffenplayhouse.com, probably the easiest way to go. And as we go off the air once again, this is Eileen Barnett with My Romance. Both of you, such a pleasure to have
you
both
on
the air. We really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
And Michael, as always, pleasure to share the mic with you, and we'll see you next week.
See you on the radio.
Just the need.
You're listening to State of the Art with Michael Sterling and Paul Strolley right here on LA Talk Radio.